Dan Clark from the University of Kent is my latest nostalgia interview guest. It was great to catch up with Dan. He's the e-learning manager at the University of Kent, and Dan talks about the power that technology has in learning and teaching. We talk about our experiences during lockdown of rapid change and how technology can make things happen. Dan talks about the time when he stays away from technology because it's a massive part of his day job. We talk about the days before the internet and the important role played by physical products. Now, Dan is from Cheshire. He talks about his Lake District connection, why it's such a magical place for him, and how Cornwall was his go-to place as a child where there was a different pace of life. We talk about the notion of counterpoint. We learn why music is important to Dan. He talks about his earliest musical memories and getting an electric guitar on his 15th birthday, forming a band at the end of secondary school and growing up at a time when the Manchester music scene was huge. We talk about school reunions, the rose-tinted view of past experiences, how our perceptions of the past are shaped by our experiences. We talk about the notion of a fixed career plan and the difference between personal, academic, and career goals. Dan talks about the tutors at Manchester who inspired him. We learn about his running predilections, which started in later years, and how it is good from a well-being sense. Dan talks about always having had a nostalgic disposition. He looks back to think about how he got to where he is now. He talks about health anxieties, how they can be turned to a positive outcome, how the past makes us who we are. We learn about Dan's interest in abandoned buildings, which he photographs, and how it led to him appearing on Ghost Hunting with Girls Aloud. And he tells us about his recurring dream and why he looks back more than he looks forward. It was an enormous pleasure for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to catch up with Dan Clark. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a great pleasure for my latest nostalgia interview to meet Dan Clark. And we were just saying, Dan, that although we've both been at the university, I think, was it 15 years in your case, 18 in mine?
That's right, yeah.
We've met maybe on one occasion before
just
today.
Once, I believe. Possibly online in the last year, maybe, yeah. But only face-to-face once.
Yeah. And do you want to say a bit about what you do at the University of Kent?
So I am the e-learning manager, which means that I manage the e-learning team, a team of learning technologists. I guess the best way of describing that is that we are the people responsible for helping academic staff like yourself to use technology in their teaching. So you would imagine that the last couple of years for us has been quite busy with the pandemic, etc., has thrust us into the spotlight somewhat.
And it must have been hard for you because obviously you would have been working at home during the pandemic,
yeah,
and yet trying to sort out people's sort of IT issues, but doing so virtually. I'm guessing it would have just made you have to rethink the nature of your job.
It did. I think we tend to think of ourselves as the people that enable academic staff to use technology, and so we had to adapt very quickly to that, and suddenly being thrust into that spotlight where we were quite a niche team in a niche department that people called upon us when they wanted to do something interesting with technology, to suddenly have that turned on its head. We were the team that could enable teaching, learning to continue throughout the pandemic. That was quite frightening, really, because we're quite a small team, obviously supported by information services for all their technical prowess, etc. For us, it was a case of working with academic colleagues to show them structuring their virtual learning environment, how to use lecture recording, etc. So it's been an interesting couple of years, and I think what it's done is it's shown the power that technology can have in learning and teaching, but it's also shown how technology can, if it's not used correctly, it can be somewhat disastrous at times as well.
Because I remember the panic, and it was literally a sort of rabbit in the headlights type scenario when we went into lockdown and were told effectively, with immediate effect, don't teach your students, go online. Yeah. And I was sitting in this very office and thinking, how do I teach my students online? And I had a webcam, but I didn't know I had a webcam built in. But I'd never used that. Mm-hmm. I had a handful of Skype meetings in my life. All my teaching events were face-to-face, and obviously I used the computer in the office all the time, but not for teaching. So it was almost as though there was no joining of the dots. Mm-hmm. And then within a matter of weeks or months, suddenly that became the default. It was like, why didn't we do this earlier?
It changed very quickly. And I think it was that initial move online that perhaps convinced a number of people that actually it's not as scary as you think. It's those initial steps for, okay, this is how you can convey your material in it through a different medium. I remember it was a Sunday night, I believe, where we got an email saying that's it, we're going into lockdown, Prime Minister's announcement, and it was very, very quick, a very quick turnaround from everything's face to face to suddenly, okay, get us out of this hole.
Yeah,
just enjoyable when you look back on it, but at the time it was quite frightening, really.
Yeah, because I remember I think we went into lockdown on the Monday, the 23rd, my parents' wedding anniversary. So I remember, and I think I was in work. That was my last day, obviously, for what was more than 6 months, and I recall either then or maybe on the Friday just before. I was trying to find some of the rooms in this very building, on this very corridor, that were empty, so I could record my lectures for the following week, knowing that I wouldn't be able to do them face-to-face. And then I think I had to do one of them on my phone. And, of course, very quickly I realised that it was possible to do it all via Zoom, which I'd never heard of, really, or Teams, again, never used. And although there isn't, we were just saying before we started recording that I'm not sure I would feel very nostalgic about lockdown, but what that whole experience did was just make us think more creatively, not least actually for my interviews, to be able to interview people the other side of the world. Whereas normally I'd say, well, when you're next in the UK, let's catch up. Or if I'm anywhere near you, I'll bring my equipment over and interview you. Whereas now it can be, let's do it tomorrow, as long as the time zones sort of fit together. And that's remarkable. And that's all happened very, within the space really of a matter of months.
Well, if you think of things like the conference circuit and being able to interact with your students who perhaps would have only been on campus one day a week if they were commuting students, it has opened up possibilities there. Think of the amount of conferences that I've attended now virtually that ordinarily I wouldn't have been able to attend face to face. So it has opened up opportunities. It's been an interesting couple of years. Interesting perhaps isn't the word to use, but it's been a period of rapid change, and I think there are definitely benefits, and it's shown that technology does enable things to happen sometimes. It's got to be used in the right measure, though. I'm sort of sit on the fence about that. I don't want to be too techno-deterministic about stuff.
Yeah. And do you find, because obviously your day job in that sense is very much around computers and so on, but is that something that sort of informs all that you do? Are you somebody who, I know a lot of people who sometimes, if they spend the whole day working on a computer, they'll do something very retro or something very paper-based rather than technology-based, almost as the counterpoint, or they'll do something in a different sort of setting and a different facet of their persona. So would you say that all the technology that you do as part of your job, is that kind of something that imbues all of your existence?
I'm probably quite wedded to technology. My wife would definitely say I'm wedded to technology. But there are definite counterpoints in my life where I try and stay as far away from technology as I can in my long distance running. And, we go to the Lake District a lot, those sort of things. I try and stay away from technology because it is a massive part of the day job. So there is a nice separation that I can form there. But having a phone in your pocket all the time, and it's something I'm very used to now, sitting there on my email, sitting there on Facebook or Twitter. It's habitual. It's probably not good for me, but I try to draw a line when I can, if I can.
Yeah, and I think that's it, isn't it? Because I remember when I came here, before we had Facebook and social media, people would be using email to ask questions like, does anyone know a good plumber? And suddenly I went to a conference once in San Diego. I was only away for about 4 or 5 days. But when I came back, there were over 500 emails. Significant numbers of them were spam or junk. But I had to wade through all of the junk to actually know what was junk or not. And I start replying to emails. And then the replies were coming into the ones I just sent, when I hadn't even gone through all the remaining 450 that had come in since I'd been away. And I remember at that point just thinking, this has taken over my life. Mm-hmm. I came into work to do ABC, and actually I'm just being reactive to emails.
Yeah.
But so I can imagine in your case, you need that separation.
I need that separation, but the thing it's both a benefit, but it's a bit of a curse as well, is the immediacy of information as well. So we can Google anything. I can find the answer to any question, maybe not any question, but a lot of questions, just by getting my phone out, Googling it, and looking for the answer to that question. And I was thinking about this the other day, that actually part of the joy of finding out something 10, 15 years ago was, or even longer, was that sort of chasing a paper trail. Or the example I can give is with music that I might be interested in, trying to find this thread for, you've got your album notes, oh, this guitar is played on this, or it's produced by such and such a person. You don't have the ability to Google that. You didn't have the ability to Google that back in the day. And so you'd often read the liner notes of albums and you think, oh, this was produced by such and such. And you'd go to a music shop and you'd open up the back of the CD case and you'd say, that was produced by someone. And you'd suddenly, you'd make the connections without the immediacy of that information being so apparent there. And I kind of missed that because I found it to be quite a nice challenge. It was, you're always discovering things, whether it's music or literature and things like that. Whereas now that information is just there, the music's on demand, you don't need to make those connections.
No, you're right, because my children are very young, but if they want to know something, or if they want to watch something, whatever they want to watch, they press a button on the TV and they will watch it. Whereas when I was younger, you'd have to look through the radio or TV schedules and see if your programme was on. And maybe it was delayed because of the football or something, you know, and, oh, we'll have to wait 2 weeks before the next episode. Whereas these days, you know, you can watch anything on demand. But something has been taken away from that. I remember once I was looking for, in the days of VHS, I was looking for Hitchcock's North by Northwest, and there was a period when you just couldn't get hold of it anyway. It wasn't available on VHS. And I think someone said, well, you know, maybe you'll find a second-hand copy. So I was living in West Wales, so I made the physical journey to London and went around, I think, Soho and all sorts of places where there were second-hand video or record stores to see if I could find a copy. Mm-hmm. And I actually wasn't successful, but I did find one around that kind of period. This would have been, what, 1996. But there was something about the journey of actually almost the commitment and saying, right, you know, this is my goal. I'm looking for something. I'm really keen to see this film. And it kind of made it all the more exciting, was these days you say, oh, what shall I watch? I'll watch North by Northwest. Press a button and it's there.
Yeah.
And somehow you think, that's a bit too easy.
I think it is. I think it is that on-demand culture that we have. I think you lose a lot of the magic of discovering something organically. Certainly music is always an example I use of that, because, you know, I listen to a lot of music and used to really enjoy sort of discovering bands and artists through the connections to other bands and artists. And now you open up Spotify or iTunes or whatever, you listen to one album, then it recommends another album and it recommends another one. It's all based on these preferences that an algorithm has decided that you will like, rather than you making your own connections and threads through it.
No, because I remember the days when I remember that Toya Wilcox had an EP out in 1981 or so, and there was a special cover that only, you know, limited number. Mm-hmm. And so you'd go to Woolworths or HMV or whatever in those days and hope that you were one of the lucky ones who got this particular cover. And of course, they were collector's items, and somehow the online version can never, I mean, in a way, it's, you know, it means that there's no risk of ripping it or finding there's a crease in it or something like that. But somehow that immediacy sometimes takes away from the magic.
I miss having that physical product. I mean, you know, I grew up in the generation where we buy CDs. Mm. So I'm not talking about vinyl, I'm not talking about cassettes really, but still having a physical product that you could open up, you could read through the liner notes, having a rack of CDs, and you could sort of go down the list and choose something to listen to based on whatever mood you were in that day, based on what the album cover looked like, what the spine of the album cover, those kind of things. You just don't get that now. It's far too immediate. It's far too it's presented to you just on a plate, and I miss that the physicality of music.
Yeah, because I make lots of physical trips to the cinema, and some people will say, "Well, you know, but you can watch that at home. It's free on Netflix or Prime. Why would you pay money to go to the cinema?" I was thinking, that, you know, that's the wrong question.
It's the wrong question. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It certainly is. And I think it's nice to see that there is this vinyl revival and things like that. It does give me some hope that people are still interested in the physicality of those sort of things. And yeah, keep going to the cinema. You can't let that go.
Yeah, exactly. In a way, it's a very retro for me, very return, because that's what I did when I was a student all those decades ago. So I'm kind of picking up on something.
Full circle, then.
Yeah, so I sort of dipped out and dipped back in. But you mentioned the Lake District, and is that the part of the world that you're from?
I'm from Cheshire, so it's not a million miles away. I grew up in a small town called Northwich, which is in the pretty much between Chester and Manchester. But my wife and I visit the Lake District probably three or four times a year. She is from Canterbury, but she visited the lakes, I think, throughout her childhood. I discovered it quite late for some reason. She was the one that took me there for the first time. So we've both really fallen in love with it. So we go very often and we just walk. It's a place that's sort of shaped by the physical environment, by the weather. And so it always feels like a different place every time we go. So despite it being, it's not particularly huge, you do feel like you get a different experience on each trip. That's what I like about it. It's something different depending on what the weather's like, depending on the time of year. It's a wonderful place. If I could find a job up there.
I know. Well, brilliant. I went there on holiday in 2012 when my eldest daughter was just a few months old. And yeah, it is magical, but we also went there. I stayed in a cottage. I think it was a B&B, but it was very sort of a B&B. There was a cottage in 1987. And it was beautiful because it's sort of, I always feel like in America where you've got the big cities, but you've also got, you know, each state is very different. And you know, Hawaii and New York, for example, couldn't be more different. And then you've got Montana with the big sort of outback. And then you've also got some of the states that have a bit more, you know, snow, like Alaska or whatever. But in your case, I think with the Lake District, that's the British equivalent. That it's, you know, there are lots of seaside towns, but this has a different sort of tourist industry. And you haven't just got one lake, you've got several of them. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of feels that it's got everything that you could, if you're into that kind of thing, and you've got the countryside. So it's a great sort of summer holiday vacation that isn't seaside based.
I think you do get a real variation. When we go there, you find that the Lakeland areas, the towns around the lakes are very busy. Whereas when you're up on the fells, it's often quite quiet. There's more popular fells than other ones, but I like the solitude of it. I think that's the thing that draws me and my wife there, is that it is, when you're up on the fells, very quiet, and you get that peace and serenity that perhaps you don't get in day-to-day life. I think there's something really organic and very natural about it. As I say, being away from technology and being away from hustle and bustle of day-to-day life, it's just you and nature around you, which is what I really, really enjoy.
Yeah, and you said that you discovered it in later years, but do you have any sort of memories from childhood of doing something like that? May not be in the Lake District, but where that sort of solitude, that sort of go-to place.
It was Cornwall. That was the place that me and my parents used to go to. We would go down maybe a couple of times a year and stay. We tended to stay around the Helford Estuary, which is another beautiful part of the country, a very different way of life, much slower pace. And I've got really great memories of that. I think the first time we went was probably 1990. It was 1990. I remember the 1990 World Cup was on. That's my recollection. That it was on the TV all the time. And we went there probably 5 or 6 years in a row, and we'd probably stay in and around the same location. And it was, I used to look forward to it. So I was throughout primary school and then into the early years of secondary school, I used to really look forward to those holidays because there was a very different feel to very look different look and feel to the environment there. It was, as I say, it was very quiet and just a completely different world from where I grew up.
I think, isn't it, that we talked about journeys a moment ago, but you see, to get to Cornwall, certainly from, well, obviously from, perhaps even more so, actually, from Cheshire, but certainly from Kent as well, because I was in there the summer before lockdown, because we looked at that, there's that magic, that pre-lapsarian age, you know, when we could travel, and, you know, little did we know that we wouldn't have those opportunities for the next couple of years. But I went to Sir Dives in 85, and I remember the sea being very blue, and went back there again in 2019, and with a bit of trepidation, because I thought, well, what if it doesn't match my memory? But it largely did, actually. I mean, obviously, when I went there in 85, I was, not even 12, going on 12, and then went back as a proper adult in my 40s. But I could see what would have made an impression on me when I was young.
Yeah.
And that, the splendour of going somewhere. I mean, if you live in Sir Dives, you might sort of just, you know, you want to go somewhere completely different. But to actually come from somewhere else, you really felt you were stepping outside of time.
Yes, I think that's right. I think I've got really lovely memories of being in Helford Village, going to things like the Shipwright Arms and Mullion Cove and St Michael's Mount, and just it just being very, very different from my home environment, and and sort of longing to be back there when we went home, and that long journey back up the M5 and then the M6, yeah, being slightly miserable that we'd have to wait another 8-10 months until we could go back again. But really lovely memories of that. Mum and Dad must have really enjoyed it, because we went so many times.
Yeah. Although you just made me think, because when you were young, I was the same. I was really sad. I actually felt really upset to be leaving somewhere, because you if we were staying in a B&B, you'd get to know the people who ran it, and you sort of thought, oh no, I really enjoyed these last few days, I'll miss you. But then when you're a bit older, sometimes you think, I can't wait to go to get away. Because sometimes, you know, holidays are great, but the idea of the holiday that goes on forever actually, you know, goes against the grain of what a holiday is. So you need a suitable amount of time to immerse yourself in a different culture.
Yeah.
But in order to return, as you did, you know, every year in your case in Cornwall with your family, then you also need to know that you stay for just the right amount of time so that you appreciate it, and then reintegrate to your day-to-day life. So you've got the right kind of balance.
It's the right balance. I often think that, I mentioned before, wouldn't it be wonderful to live in the Lake District if I could find a job there? And part of me thinks, if I did find a job in the Lake District and lived up there, would it feel the same? Would it be as special as it is visiting 3-4 times a year? Part of me thinks it probably would. Mm. I'm very envious of a friend of mine that lives in the middle of the Lake District, and I always say, you're so lucky. And he says, I know, I'm quite lucky, but I think if I were to live there, would it feel the same? I don't know. Maybe I'd have to live there to know the answer to that question.
I was talking to someone who went to Hawaii, which was the other side of the world, quite literally. So, you know, you're thinking, we've made this effort to go there, but if you live in Hawaii, what would you do? And I think this is what we learned, is that people in Hawaii, that there is a term for it as well, about some sort of, you know, like cabin fever equivalent, mm-hmm, but you need to go and do something different. So I think it's the counterpoint. So you'd need to go to the big city.
Yeah.
And once you've experienced the big city and imbibed that, then you're like, I'm ready now to return. But even, you know, it's like funny when you're in a seaside town or holiday destination and you see what do they call them, travel agents, and you're thinking, well, that's for residents, you know, but if you're in the holiday destination, why, you know, what's the point? But of course, that's the very thing, that if you live in a place, I suppose Canterbury has that to a point, but if you live somewhere where it's very touristy, you need to get away from that touristy place in order to have your own equivalent.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think people perhaps judge the places they travel to and the places they visit based on their experiences of where they live. So I think it is important wherever you are to get that change and to get that, as you say, that counterpoint. I always laugh when we're in Keswick in the lakes and see the travel agency there. I remember saying to my wife, where do people go on holiday that live in the Lake District? It's just such a stupid question to ask. Of course they go on holiday.
Yeah.
But in my mind, it's like you live in the most perfect place. Why would you want to leave? But it's the change.
Yeah. I think you're right. So if you got a job, I mean, that's probably it, isn't it? It's the allure of the place. If you got a job in the Lake District, I'm sure you'd be very happy there. But you also, perhaps you'd have to find something just to recalibrate a bit, because otherwise the home and the holiday become the same. That doesn't work.
Yeah, you need the separation. Probably come on holiday to Kent. Just for old time's sake, maybe.
Exactly, yeah. That's nostalgia. What about other things, you know, as a child? Because you were mentioning music a moment ago. Is that something that's quite important to you?
It's really important to me. It's been a part of my life for a long time, since I was... My earliest memories of music are travelling to Scotland, in fact, where my granddad had taken ill in Scotland, and at the last minute we had to drive all the way up to Oban, me, my mum and dad, and we stayed in a rickety little caravan that we've managed to book at the last minute. This was 1987, so I was 4. So I've got sketchy memories of it, but what I do remember is my dad had the Dire Straits Brothers in Arms cassette pretty much on repeat for the entire journey. And there was this synergy between what I was seeing and what I was hearing, which I've never been able to recreate in through any other piece of music. I think the Brothers in Arms, the track starts with the words, these mist-covered mountains are home now for me. We were there driving through the mountains, you know. So as soon as I hear those opening, the open synthesizer and Mark Knopfler's guitar, immediately taken back to 1987, driving through the glens around Loch Lomond on the way into the Highlands. Always takes me back as soon as I hear that.
And I'm just thinking, because the film Local Hero,
yes,
which, yes, was probably around the time you were born, it was made. And, of course, that is Scotland, and that's Mark Knopfler doing the soundtrack.
Yep.
And that, I think, is a very interesting blend. Because I don't know where, I can't remember where Mark Knopfler is from.
I think he grew up in Newcastle, but I think he was actually born in Glasgow.
Right, so there is a Scottish link, but this film has a very sort of whimsical sort of nature to it. But I can now you mentioned it, I can exactly see how Mike Knopfler was actually a perfect, you know, composer for that for that soundtrack in terms of the beauty. Definitely. That it's capturing, the sort of being from the outside, in that case, the American oil tycoon who's in the small village and then outwitted by the locals.
Definitely, and as I say, it was the perfect soundtrack to those memories. Mm. And I still listen to Dire Straits now. I'm quite a big fan. But music has always been quite a big part of my life, mainly through my dad. Music was always playing at home. So I grew up hearing Dire Straits, Led Zeppelin, the Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, those sort of things. And I got my first guitar on my 15th birthday. So my interest in music sort of inevitably led to me wanting to make my own music. And on my 15th birthday, I got this electric guitar, so which I've still got. It doesn't have any strings on it. But
I have all the guitars now,
but I don't have the. I can't quite part with it. It doesn't work anymore. But I don't have the. It's too sentimental to get rid of. So it's stuffed in a corner. So it's obviously not that sentimental.
Well, yeah, but in my office here, I've got all these VHS cassettes and so on, which I'm never going to watch again. You know, I'm a big believer in embracing new technology, but each one of those cassettes has a memory of a particular place and the time. And I sort of feel, well, I don't really want to get rid of them, but I'd miss them if they weren't there. But, you know, I may have no intention of ever touching or playing them again.
Yeah, definitely. I think people hold on to objects because of that emotional connection.
Yeah.
I get quite sentimental about things like that because it was bought for me by my parents, and because it was a birthday present, it would feel wrong to get rid of it. Whereas if I bought it myself, I probably wouldn't have the same sentimental connection to it.
Yeah.
It just reminds me of a time in my life where I was coming to the end of my secondary school, really interested in music, making music, and that voyage of discovery, getting guitar lessons and suddenly realising that, you know, you can make sounds on this thing, and actually this sounds okay, and, you know, learning really basic songs and getting better and better, that learning curve. And it was, you know, really lovely, interesting times to be creating music. It was,
and did you play, like, for yourself, or did you ever play with anybody, or for anybody else?
Well, inevitably ended up in a band, which tends to be the thing to do. We formed a band at the end of secondary school, and that various incarnations of that band stayed until I graduated from my undergrad. So probably 5, maybe 6 years of playing with other musicians. We started off, we were not very good. You know, we would play in my mum and dad's loft space. And it was just a racket. And then progressively, as we went through different lineup changes, we were all right. I mean, it good enough to play at gigs in Manchester and Chester and places like that. And it was a really wonderful experience being in a band. I can't really compare it to anything, because when you're that age, you feel like you can take over the world. And so there was a real sense that we were all pulling in the same direction, and we just needed to be at the right place at the right time, and something might happen for us. It never did, obviously. But
also, I can imagine how contagious it was. There's Manchester of all places, because I went to university in 91, I think there's exactly a decade between us, and I remember a friend at school saying that he'd apply to Manchester to do whatever subject, law or something, I don't know. But he said that suddenly it became impossible to get into Manchester because everyone, because of the music scene, wanted to get in there. So there's just that sort of moment, because you had the Beatles in the 60s in Liverpool and Jerry and the Pacemakers and all that. And just the sort of sense in different ages, just different cities, you know, suddenly something is happening whereby, you know, it didn't work out for you and your bandmates, but you would have had good reason to think that it might have done, because that, you know, in a way you had all the resources in place. You're in the right place, maybe the right place at the wrong time or whatever it might be, but there's a different trajectory there that you could have been on.
Absolutely. I think it was that was the place where it was all happening. Being a teenager in the late 90s was a really interesting time. There was this sense of optimism. I remember 1997, New Labour coming in, and being aware that things seemed to be changing. I didn't know what was changing because I wasn't particularly politically aware at that age, but I remember this feeling that anything was possible. And so I grew up through Britpop movement, and with Manchester on the doorstep, it did feel like there was this sort of cultural revolution going on, and it was very close to where I was growing up, which was interesting to be part of that and to see that and be able to hop on a train and go to gigs, etc. in Manchester. I was quite fortunate to do that.
And are you still in touch with the other bandmates?
I am, yeah, we still are. We actually got back together about 4 or 5 years ago and rented a little rehearsal space and played together for the first time in, it would have been about, must have been 10 years since we played together. We were a little bit rusty. Mm. But what's interesting is that how quickly muscle memory kicks in with certain bass lines and picking up melodies and riffs that we thought we'd forgotten, and suddenly they out of the ether they appear.
Because it's similar, isn't it, to as I've done the reunion circuit, if that's what it's called, in terms of university, and I was wary of doing it. Maybe I feel now I could almost do it with some school friends, but there's a lot of baggage there, and sort of in a way I am the same. I know I'm the same person as I was then in some ways, and that's the reason why I don't want to go back, because I'm much more comfortable being me as an adult than being me as a child. But university, I have been imbibing that for about 4 or 5 years. But what was always so fascinating is that you'd meet people you hadn't seen in literally decades, but you just picked up from where you left off. You were almost finishing a conversation you might have had 30 years earlier. And that's bizarre. But you suddenly realised that there was something that you had in common all those years ago. And unless you've suddenly changed your character or personality, the fact that you're still connecting with them just goes to show that whatever differences of family or place and job and career and all sorts of life experiences, in a funny way, you all grew up in the same sort of place. You went to the same university. Mm-hmm. You've got enough going there to sustain a conversation or two over a couple of beers.
I find that quite reassuring in a way, because obviously living in Kent now, I'm geographically detached from a lot of the people I grew up with and was friends with. So it is when you see them, when you can, as you say, slot back into those conversations and just pick up the conversations that you sort of left 10 years ago. It's like putting on a very familiar pair of shoes. It feels very natural, and it's very reassuring, which I quite like. I'd feel quite anxious if I met people from my early years and university days, and if it was jarring, I'd find that difficult. Purely because it would show that I'd grown up and they'd grown up and we'd sort of parted and things were different. So it is nice that we can get back in the room, pick up the instruments and the same jokes.
Because that can be the fear sometimes of going back to the past and finding that it wasn't as you wanted it to be. And it's like the Lake District, because maybe that's not a good example, because the Lake District is always, it's a very unspoiled and protected in that way. So you're not suddenly going to find that it's a big, urban, metropolis, because, that's never going to happen. But sometimes you go back to a place, and it can be where you went to university, and you kind of think, actually, I'd like that place to be where it is in my head. And it's been many years, and I've got a very sort of clear sense of, and that word counterpoint keeps coming up, but that was a big part of my life. But in going back, you're opening all sorts of doors, unlocking memories. But also, if you find the place isn't exactly as you remembered it, then, in some ways, there might be a sense of, this is a part of my identity, and look at it now. So, wish I hadn't gone. But what I did discover is that it was the people, not the place, who made it special. And we'd all grown up together. I was in my early 20s and now in my late 40s kind of thing. So that was the given, but we were all in the same place together. And we might as well have been back to our 20-year-old selves. So actually, it didn't have to be Lampeter where we met. It could have been anywhere else. But being there, being in the same place, there was enough of a connection to make it a really viable and quite special long weekend.
Yeah, I think that there is that sense of people do have that fear. Things like, you see, I'm getting to an age now where people are trying to arrange school reunions and those sort of things. And I'm reticent about that, because a school reunion is bigger than your friendship group.
Yeah.
and it's going to invoke memories of things that perhaps weren't positive from your youth. So I think there's a slightly rose-tinted view of past experiences, and as you say, it's the people that make those experiences, both good and bad. And I think there is a risk that you'll be left disappointed if you school reunion being an example of that. If you go to something like that, you suddenly find, I didn't get on with that person, and I still don't get on with that person. Yeah. And I think, there is a view of the past that perhaps things were better, and actually that's not always the case.
Yeah, and I think sometimes as well, we maybe mentally, I don't know if correct may not be the word, but we reframe the past, perhaps in a way of just as a coping mechanism, because you know there are all sorts of things sometimes that might be injurious to us, and maybe you're still bitter about it. But when the decades pass, you see the context and you think, well, actually, maybe it made me a stronger person or whatever. But or at least you're finding justification for the fact that that happened and you moved on. But then in going back, sometimes you might actually make peace. And I always think it works both ways, because sometimes there are some people that, you know, who I wouldn't particularly want to see again. But then, at the same time, I'm sort of thinking, but I don't know what sort of life journey they... I'm assuming that they're still static. Mm. I'm still imagining that they're still the same, maybe not very nice people that they were, who used to call me names or whatever, you know, as people do when they're young. And I sort of look back on that period and I think, but actually maybe they got children themselves, and maybe they've had a bit of a rethink. Or maybe they're just exactly the same as they were. And then it's that difficult thing. Is it worth opening up that can of worms? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes you end up deliberating, you never actually come, you know, you end up just not doing anything about it, you just sort of kick it down the road.
I like that view of that. You do look back and imagine everyone you were experienced the past with is exactly the same, and it's only you that's changed, but actually they may well have changed as well.
Because there's a film about that, which Romy and Michelle's high school reunion, and it's actually interesting because I saw that 10 years after I left, not even that actually, gosh, I'm 97. And at the time, I think the characters in that were like, it was 10 years since they'd left school. This was in America. At the time, I was thinking, this is why I would never go to a reunion. But now, sort of 25 years on from that, I'm thinking, actually, I don't care anymore. Because what am I proving? At that age, I think I didn't quite know where I was going with my life. And I was more worried that I'd go back and all these people had a very clear sense of journey. And I'd be the only one who was, you know, because I was doing a PhD at the time. And I was like, well, I'm not really earning any money. It's not a proper job, you know. And so there's a little bit of sort of limbo. My life hasn't quite started. But in my mind, all these other people were terribly successful, had lots of money, and would be looking down on me. And maybe they would have done. But that was based on what I just perceived from a decade earlier.
Yeah. I think your perception of the past is shaped by your experiences at that time. So as you grow up, you look back, and it's quite difficult to know what the situation's going to be now, isn't it?
Yeah.
And to look back on how people may have changed, and I think you don't realise that everyone's going down this, or going through the same journey as you. You know, they're all maturing, getting older, and having different life experiences that shapes who they are. And so, I tend to look back quite a lot, but not want to go back, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. But I was going to ask you, how did you enter your profession?
So I got to the University of Kent, or I started working at the University of Kent in 2007. And I was originally working in the Centre for Music Technology, so there was a musical connection there. And I worked as a technician software instructor in that department, and had four very happy years there up on the Medway campus. And I remember seeing a job advertised for a learning technologist, and it was the title that struck me. I thought, what's a learning technologist? This looks interesting. It's a word under technologist. What's a technologist? So I looked at the job description, and it was effectively helping academic colleagues to best utilise technology in their teaching. I thought, oh, I have a go at applying for that, and I applied for it, and to my surprise I got the job, moved to the Canterbury campus, and I was in that role up until just before the pandemic, and then more recently promoted to team manager. And it's been interesting seeing that journey from when I joined the team as a learning technologist. It was a very niche area. It was an area that academic staff would only go to if they wanted to try something wacky or crazy, you know, I want to try this particular tool. It was not an embedded practice at all. whereas now our roles are much more ingrained. And it's interesting that we've gone on that journey as well. We've gone from the people, the go-to team when you're thinking of doing something, to the team you would go to when, just because you have to now, because it's the norm to use technology within the teaching, particularly because of the pandemic, as an example of that.
Yeah. And does that bear any resemblance to your university degree?
Not really. I did media and cultural studies was my first degree at Manchester. And I think I did that because I was interested in... I did A-level sociology, and that was perhaps the biggest eye-opener of a course I could have done. I did music, IT, and sociology. And sociology, for some reason, just awakened something inside of me that I didn't know was there. And it was this critical view of stuff, to not taking things for granted. That fed into the media and cultural studies, taking this critical stance against, you know, what the newspapers present, seeing bias in the media and things like that. And that stayed with me because I'm now doing a PhD part-time, and I'm doing a lot about critical theory, actually writing about a critique of educational technology. So being critical, the sector that I'm working in is quite a strange juxtaposition. But I can see the thread. That critical thread goes all the way back to my A-level sociology. And it's an area I really enjoy. It's an area I'm really interested in. And it's quite nice sometimes when you reflect on how did I get here? Why am I doing a PhD now? Looking back at that thread and seeing those points in your progression where you sort of bounce from one idea to another and it's taking you down certain avenues.
Yeah, because there is an element of, you know, you think of, we're all determined to do things in a certain way. But I think that we're all shaped by the things that inspire us when we're young. And sometimes you might think, oh, I want to do a career in that area. But of course, if you're passionate about something, like music, for example, but if that was your career, you know, and we're talking about the Lake District, it's the same sort of thing. If there's something that you really love and then that becomes your everyday, then perhaps that it takes the sparkle away a little bit. But the risk is you get to a point, I'm in my very late 40s now, when you sometimes think, but I haven't changed my mind. The things I wanted to do at the age of six, you know, radio, I suppose I'm doing it through the podcast, haven't changed. So there is a sense, and I'm like, well, if that's the case, and this is not just a fly in the night thing, if all these decades on, the interest, the passion, the excitement of doing something like that is still there, do I just continue to sustain it as a sort of, oh, well, in an ideal world, I would do that, end of, or do I actively seek to do that? And that's such an interesting thing, because we somehow end up where we are now, but these things are not, there's normally a thread that wherever, even if you weren't in Canterbury, you probably would find that you'd still be doing a version of what you're doing now anyway, because that's ingrained in your personality, in your nature.
I think I would agree with that. I think I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do when I left secondary school. I had no idea. It was just, the natural thing was to do A-levels. And you can see in my A-level choices that I went with music, IT and sociology are three very different subjects. And I think that's symbolic of someone that clearly didn't know what they wanted to do. And going to university, I went to Manchester because it was on the doorstep. Media and cultural studies because I was interested in that sort of thing from sociology, and I left university still not knowing what I wanted to do. And even now, as I reflect on the role I'm in now, I still think, how on earth did I get here? What's brought me to this point in my career, and where will I be in 10 years? And sometimes I think, I don't really have a plan where I'll be in 10 years, but that's okay, because things naturally fall into place. I'm fairly relaxed about things like that. I've never had a fixed career plan, a sort of fixed progression ladder. I want to do this by this age and this by this age. I'd rather things happen organically. I think that's...
I think you're right. Yes, because you can never have something that specific along the lines of, you wouldn't have said, 10 years ago, well, in 10 years' time, I want to be responding to the pandemic. You know, so you know, so that's the whole thing. But there's a sort of a sense of a set of skills, a skill set that you would apply to a particular area. But also, the interesting thing is what happens when you don't succeed in doing that. Or maybe you think, it doesn't matter. Maybe there's next year. Or maybe not ever.
Yeah.
But sometimes having something in mind whether you actualize it or it just always remains there as something that you could do in your dreams. Mm-hmm. Dreams are important, you know. It doesn't, whether you fulfill them or not, the fact is that they are there and they give you that sort of sense, almost that goal to work towards. And I think that those are important elements, but inevitably sometimes, particularly if you then find that the profession you're in is very different or the people are no longer there, then it's quite right that sometimes you probably just have to think, ooh, you know, is this necessarily the right path for me to be on?
Mm-hmm. It's strange thinking about it, but I have personal goals, I have academic goals, but I never really have career goals. I can't sort of point to things I want to do in the next 2 years professionally, where I want to go to. But I can certainly say in the next 2 years, I want to have a PhD. And personally, there's things related to my running and things like that I want to achieve. But if you ask me, what are your goals in your career? I'd really struggle. I have an RPD coming up with my manager in a few weeks. And it, you know, these are the kind of things I need to be thinking about. But actually, you know, I don't... Yeah. It's not because I'm not interested in the role. It's just... I don't have that sort of impetus to say, I want to be in this position in 2 years.
You see that actually mirrors me, because there's the macro level and the micro level. Now, the micro level means, day to day, I have to mark these essays or do these interviews or teach my students. And they're very manageable. And the frustrating thing is when you don't get those done, because you have a plan. I'll mark 8 essays today, and you don't get those 8 done because something else has intervened. So, you know, but you have a very clear sense of what you have to do. And in a way, I've been sustaining that for decades, as in on that level of doing the things immediately needed and doing them efficiently and doing them, I'd like to think, well. But if you then said to me, OK, so that's your day-to-day thing, but where will you be in 5 years' time or 10 years' time? And we talk about vision statements. We're having a strategic review at work at the moment. Now, that's where I come unstuck. And I wonder, because my nostalgia work, and I keep a diary, I'm very good at interrogating the past and what's happened, and I've got something concrete there to work with, and then sort of, okay, that's what happened 10 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever, and I start to draw all these different connections. But then to be able to say in 20 years' time, some people are brilliant at that level, the blue skies thinking. But of course, visions change, and people, you know, I've had people who've had the best ideas in the world. They're great at job interviews. They got all these visions. But do they necessarily come into place? And that, I think, is the thing, that sometimes people are good on visions, but sometimes the day-to-day also is literally the bread and butter that keeps you going. So I think it's a balance that everyone has to strike.
Definitely. I make short-term goals professionally and longer-term goals personally. I think it just seems to be the way that I'm wired to do that.
Yeah. But so you did media at university. You mentioned another degree as well, is that right? Or you hinted at the fact that there may be another degree.
So I did a master's here at Kent in higher education. It was offered by the department that I was working in, and so it seemed a natural thing to do. A free master's degree is not to be sniffed at.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you were at university the first time round in Manchester, and I'm guessing the music, you in a way, you were in a perfect place not to be doing media, but obviously it was a very, very vibrant city. But were there particular teachers who inspired you?
Yes, there was. There were several, in fact. I can remember there was an academic that was teaching us about, I think it was media representation, was one of the modules we did. I can't remember the title of the module now. But there was one of those moments where a particular concept or a particular idea was introduced, and it was this sort of light bulb moment. And one of them was, I was introduced to, you may have heard of it, it's a book called Wisconsin Death Trip, which is a book of old photographs from 1800s, late 1800s, in a town called Black River Falls in Wisconsin. Mm. And they're like newspaper photographs. And it's a compendium of these photographs of this town that was beset by illness and death and terrible weather and then famine. And it's sort of aggregated into this one book. And it just depicts quite a depressing set of circumstances. I think the point of the lecture where this book was introduced is how is the past being represented? And I remember coming out of that lecture really sort of enthused by this book, and having seen some of the photos from it, going on Amazon and buying it. I've still got a copy at home, actually. And it's fascinating looking at that depiction of the past. Black and white photographs of these seemingly very, very sorrowful people, farm workers, etc. I think it was taken by a photographer that worked for the local newspaper. So it's effectively a compendium of their work. I remember being really fascinated by that, by the imagery of how it's depicted in this physical form, and thinking about the juxtaposition of what would it have been like to live that? What was their experience? Was their experience as it's depicted in the book, or was it completely different? It's framed by it being in black and white and juxtaposed against all these different images. And I remember that I can't remember the name of the lecturer now, I should do. But I remember that was a real moment where I was my eyes opened to that, the representation of the past and how things get depicted.
Yeah, because you also mentioned the running that you do now. Now, when did that all start?
Very late.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I was not sporty as a kid. I really wasn't sporty. I hated running as a child. Absolutely hated it. I hated PE. Apart from football, that was the only thing I quite enjoyed. I put a bit of weight on in probably my late 20s, early 30s. Not much, but I put enough on for me to look in the mirror and think, I probably need to do some exercise now. And I started running and noticed that the weight came off quite quickly. And it then became quite addictive because you can see almost the immediate impact of what you're doing. And the more I ran, the better I got at it. And so I was sort of, by this point, early 30s, mid-30s. And entered a few marathons, entered races. Went from the usual, did it to lose weight, and then suddenly got fixated with racing and just improving PBs and things like that. But the recent revelation, or the recent-ish revelation, has been fell running. So Lake District is a natural place to do fell running. So, and I don't get to do it very often, 3 or 4 times a year. So I run around the roads and off-road here in Kent, but when we're up in the lakes, I'm up in the mountains.
Because I see your tweets sometimes, and of course you're talking about various obstacles in the road, well, literally obstacles in the road. There was something the other week that you tweeted that sounded like an appalling, you know, potential accident that was
all
almost...
All sorts of things, yeah. I think I try and run every day, so you do see a lot of stuff. Yeah. The fell running is a very different, different experience, though. It's almost... It's like meditation. It's quite mindful because you are in the middle of nowhere. You're by yourself. It's this serene landscape shaped by the weather. And I think you're very in touch with nature when you do things like that, because you're often running at height. You're running on really variable terrain. And every footfall is you concentrate on, because if you fall, you're really going to hurt yourself and you could end up in serious trouble. So it's the most connected I am with my physical environment, definitely.
It's interesting how that all came about, because in lockdown, of course, a lot of people put on weight, whereas I had already amassed, perhaps through cinema trips and eating hot dogs and so on, and maybe going to Rutherford here on campus every day for, you know, having a big meal, but then having another big meal in the evening. But I put on weight and my cholesterol was high. Now, I've always been very, very thin. But I was told I was overweight, and I was like, first time in my life, I almost thought it was funny, because, like, you know, I'm not that kind of person. But then in lockdown, I lost it, and so that was an interesting lesson, that it was like, okay, well, there aren't many benefits from lockdown, but actually, if that happened, maybe you don't want to just simply return. You know, you might want to carry on with your lifestyle pre-lockdown, but you've also got to make sure that you do it in such a way that your health is protected. So it's interesting that for you, you put on some weight, but you found a solution, but then you just carried on doing it. It wasn't just a sort of a temporary fix. That became a new sort of ritual.
It did. I discovered that I really enjoyed running. So after those initial few weeks of finding that it was, you know, it makes your lungs burn and, you know, it's uncomfortable when you first do it, that quickly changed into, actually, this is quite comfortable. It de-stresses me. I get half an hour in the morning where I'm out and about, and all I'm thinking about is doing 4, 5, 6 miles or whatever the distance was. And that stuck. I lost the weight and just kept going, and the distances got longer, and the environments that I ran in changed. And it's something I don't think I'll ever give up. I wish I'd started sooner. I really wish I'd seen the benefits of running when I was in my teens, but I wasn't interested then.
Yeah. And it sounds like, as we start to wrap up, Dan, I'm just thinking, it sounds like your memories seem very sort of positive, or certainly, you know, in terms of what's come out. And do you kind of feel in that sense, like, I suppose, to use the analogy of the reason why you did the running, because it was to lose weight, but, you know, there's a negative thing, and therefore you combat it, and then you turn it into a positive. So is that, does that, that seems like a sort of a model that works for you?
I've always had a nostalgic disposition, I feel. And that's not necessarily a view that looks back on everything as being positive. I'd look back often to think about how I got to where I am. But I also look back to think as a way of trying to understand why I react to things in certain ways. It's like a lens onto my past. So why am I reacting in this way? Why is this making me anxious? Why is it making me think these thoughts? And I use that nostalgic disposition to be a view onto that, to almost sort of cleanse that thought process, that it's natural. I'm thinking this because this happened 10, 15, 20 years ago, whatever. And I think that that's probably a healthy thing for me to do, because it's helping me come to terms with stresses or anxieties I may have in life. The example I give is that my dad was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1996. So, I mean, he's fine, still knocking around. But I was 12, 13 at the time. So for someone of that age, it probably affected me more than I realised. And that's manifested itself in later life as a general anxiety about my parents and are they okay? And, you know, any doctor's appointments they have and things like that. It's like, you know, why are you going to the doctors? Is this routine? Just this general concern for their health as they're, you know, they're in their mid-70s now. But I think in my own life, I'm quite paranoid about things like, you know, I don't like having blood tests. I don't like going to the doctors and things like that. My wife's like, just why? What's the problem? And I can sort of point it all back to that period in 96 when my dad was diagnosed, because it's a, I wouldn't say it's a mistrust of medicine. It's not that. It's the fact that things do go wrong and bad things are discovered and people get ill. And I've found that it's quite soothing looking back and realising, why don't I want to have this blood test? You know, if I had to have a blood test, I'd stress about it for days and days and days. And it's a way of dealing with that phobia, that anxiety, is going, I feel like this because this happened 25 years ago. And that helps, I think. So I can turn those negative memories into a positive outcome, I think.
Yeah, and that's really inspiring, because it also shows that there's something that is going on, but you've got the resources, the wherewithal to deal with it. But also it's a way of saying, okay, this is the way I'm configured, so this is the way it is, so let me sort of make the most of it, rather than, I've talked to somebody the other day who was saying, oh, if you've had something debilitating in your life or whatever, well, put it all in a suitcase and dump it in the bottom of the ocean. I'm thinking, that is not the way I would do things.
No.
You know, it's like, okay, turn it into something creative, which doesn't mean to say that all things can be creative, but it's channeling it, and they're versions, I suppose, of survival narratives. It's a way of saying, or coping mechanisms. It's like, well, I'm here somehow, you know, and I overcame whatever it might be. So that journey is one bespoke, and nobody else may have gone through the same journey in exactly the same way. So it can be inspiring to others, because it also helps people deal with all those fears and neuroses, which we all have around health. And some people, I've got family members who will actively avoid going to the doctors. I know plenty of friends of mine who seem to be at the doctors every day, but they're always saying, you know, I'll come and see you, but I've got to go to the doctors first. I thought, but you must go to the doctors every week, you know. So the, you know, for whatever, everyone has their own way in to this.
I think the past makes us who we are, and I think it's healthy to look back. I think sometimes I look back perhaps too much, maybe. Like I say, I have this nostalgic disposition. But I think it is healthy to look at the points in your life and how they've affected you and how they manifest in later life. I find that quite comforting, because I talk about these threads going through your life, and I like finding those threads. You know, the thread of, why am I in this job now? How did I get here? Why am I interested in sociology, critical theory, that sort of thing? Why don't I like having blood tests? it's a way of discovering something about yourself.
Yeah, because sometimes it might be, we were talking about a previous guest before we got a recording, and how sometimes somebody might be an enigma to somebody else. But if you're an enigma to yourself, then that's even more worrying, because people can read you in however, whatever way they want, and you can play games with that. But if you don't quite know your own reasons for how you got here, or you feel that you're drifting, or it's all a bit random, then that can be a bit debilitating, because you think, you know, have I taken the wrong path? Did I actively seek the wrong path, or did I just stumble through it? And, you know, and those are the existential questions sometimes about, you know, what is the point to this? And do I just accept that's who I am, or do I change course at whatever age? And I think in that sense, you may not know what you're doing, we're doing in 10 or 20 years' time, but actually that can be healthy in some ways, because the alternative is, oh, I'll be doing that, and what if you're not doing it? Then you feel this sense of displacement all the time, because you're never, you know, in the real world, we don't get to actualise all of our goals.
No, I think it's nice not having those fixed goals, because that's what you then measure yourself against in time. Well, I mentioned this nostalgic disposition that I have, and that has manifested itself through all throughout my life as this fascination with the past, and that's come out through in various ways over the years, but perhaps most strongly in my interest in things like architecture, in particular abandoned buildings and abandoned locations. People think it's a really strange hobby. I wouldn't really call it a hobby, it's just an interest, a general interest that I have. But I've, over the years, been lucky enough to photograph abandoned structures and buildings, and I can point back exactly to a point in my childhood where I became interested in this, and it was 1991, and me and my mum and dad used to go for walks in East Cheshire by the River Dane, and there was an abandoned farmhouse there, and it always used to fascinate me because we walked past it and it was completely dilapidated, surrounded by trees, and it was completely overgrown. There's old cars in the yard. Lovely location. And one day we happened to be walking there, and the door was ajar to it. It was boarded up, but the door was ajar, so obviously someone had broken in. My dad was perhaps just as inquiring as me, said, "Shall we have a look inside?" So he prized the door open, and we went in, and it was like we'd stepped back into the 1960s. The wallpaper was this garish, flowery wallpaper from the 60s. There was still crockery around. There was old furniture. There was a old enamel sink. And I was probably seven or eight at that age. And we just, you know, very carefully walked around this building. And it was like my eyes were just open to this view onto the past. I remember going away as we drove home that day, just sitting there in silence, being absolutely fixated with what I'd seen. Really powerful moment. And I can't quite articulate just this, having this view onto the past that I'd never had before. It was like I was living and breathing what it must have been like for the people that lived there. Now I wanted to know who lived there, how long has it been abandoned for, what were their lives like? And that thread or that interest has stayed with me all through the years. And so in my later life, more recently after university, that had turned into this interest in photographing these locations. And so I was lucky enough to take photographs of a abandoned tuberculosis sanatorium in Cheshire, which had been abandoned for 25 years. And it had been a TB sanatorium, it had been a psychiatric unit. I think it ended life as a care home for the elderly. But it sitting there in the middle of Delamere Forest, completely shut away, and I'd managed to get access to it to take photographs. And that, through some weird confluence of events, led me to appear on Ghost Hunting with Girls Aloud, which was a slightly surreal experience.
Did you know when you went on the programme that Girls Aloud were going to be on? What a fascinating juxtaposition of something about which you have this great interest, and suddenly the world of celebrity.
It was definitely my 15 minutes of fame. It was quite surreal. It started off with, I'd taken the photographs at the hospital, I put them on the internet on Flickr, and didn't think anything else of it. There was a small community of people that used to look at each other's abandoned building photos. One day, I got an email from someone from a production company saying, "We're really interested in your photos. We're thinking of using this location for a TV programme. you seem to know a little bit about the history. Would you mind meeting us on the site just to tell us about the history of the building? And I thought, it's only up the road. Why not? This was 2005, so before I'd moved down here, moved down to Kent, and drove to the still abandoned hospital, and to my surprise, met Yvette Fielding, which was completely unexpected, because Yvette Fielding and her husband, Carl Beattie, were the production team around this programme, and it transpired that they were making a Ghost Hunting with Girls Aloud programme. They said, it's going to be Girls Aloud, and basically going to be put in different scenarios, and would you talk to us about the history? So I you know, talked about the building. It was built in 1905, and etc., and went through all the different things it had been used for, and didn't think anything else of it, drove home, and the next day I got a phone call saying, we quite like the way you describe the hospital, would you like to appear on the programme when we film it? We'll pay you. And I thought, okay, it's 250 quid. So I think 3 weeks later I was there filming with Girls Aloud, which was a really unusual experience. It was a juxtaposition between this dilapidated, really sorrowful old hospital that was completely overgrown, overtaken by nature, and having these celebrities there and the whole world of celebrity. So it was a really strange few hours of filming with them.
And what were they like?
They were fine. They were mildly bemused by my hobby of taking photos of abandoned buildings. They thought it was an unusual thing for someone of my age to do. They were actually more interested in it than I thought they would be, or some of them were. They seemed genuinely quite perturbed by the building and its history. From my point of view, I never felt there was anything spooky about these places. They're just old buildings. I was more fascinated based on their social history, but clearly the programme was set up to... Yeah.
But anyway, it reminds me of Jeremy Corbyn, I think. Doesn't he have an interest in old gutters, sewers, apparently?
Yeah.
So he has this interest. So apparently he says when he's walking down the road, he's looking at the age or the shape or the design or the structure of these sewers. And, of course, that seems a very niche hobby. And, of course, when he was leader of the Labour Party, it was thought, well, that seems... Of course, there are all sorts of puns that people could make about, you know, all put sorts. The word sewer and leader of the opposition together. But actually, that those interests sometimes say a lot more about us, actually, sometimes, because of, you know, the underside, the things that may have sort of come into contact with the world of celebrity for a brief moment. But actually, in itself, it's something which is so unusual, but something that you probably ought to ensure that you harness, because not a lot of people would have difficulty, I think, going down that kind of path.
I think for me, and a couple of people have asked me about this, would I be interested in that building if it was still in use? Yeah. And I think the answer to that question is no, I probably wouldn't. So it's not an architectural interest per se. It's the history of the building, the past history of the building, and the people that used to work there, the people that were treated there, why it's in the state it's in now, why did it close down? It's that view onto the past that I'm interested in, rather than the physical location. It's the, I guess, that sort of metaphysical location, the space and place of the building that I was really fascinated in. So going all the way back to that farmhouse in Cheshire in 1991 with my mum and dad, the thing that really awakened this thing in my mind was who used to live there, what sort of lives did they have? And that was where that sort of nostalgic view, that nostalgic disposition sort of was awoken in me for these sort of things. And I can still see it now. You know, if we're driving anywhere, when we go into the Lake District, is a good example. Off the M6, as you pass Lancaster, there's an asylum, a former insane asylum, Lancaster Moor, and that's still abandoned. Every time we drive past it, I always feel I'm turning to the left, looking at this huge Gothic building that's standing there, completely empty. And it's always sort of tugs at my heartstrings. I think, what was life like there? Who was sent there? How were people treated there? So it's just something that stuck with me.
And what about the dreams that you had when you were young? I mean, what would your younger self have imagined that you'd be doing now?
Oh, that's a difficult question to answer. I never had a career in mind or even a job in mind. Went through the usual, the various professions that I thought I could do. I think the strongest sense I had is that when I was in my late teens, mid to late teens, when I was in the band, I guess I thought I would work in music somewhere. Maybe not as a musician, but in and around music somehow, whether that's as a recording engineer or something like that. And obviously, that's not what happened. But I'm still involved with technology, and I'm still involved with, I guess my role is creative. It's helping other people be creative. So going back to our discussion before, I think it's not a million miles from what I would have imagined. But I don't know. Looking back, I don't know what my past self would make of my present self.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because that's the interesting twist. You know, it's almost like the conversation between the younger self and the older self, and what the older self could teach the younger self, and actually also perhaps vice versa.
I think the older self teaching the younger self would just be to say, "Don't worry." Just, you know, as a teenager, the things you worry about and the your anxieties, they just disappear. They're replaced by other things, and you can't see that because you don't have the life experiences when you're that age. But the older self would say to the younger self, "There's lots of stuff that you're stressing out about now that it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
these things will go away."
No, because I've got young children, and the whole sort of they have to do the Kent test, and what if it doesn't work out, and you know, will their futures be ruined, and you know, all these sort of things, and you think, gosh, when I was their age, I didn't, you know, I'm not from Kent, but you know, we didn't even have any of those sort of questions. But somehow, you know, I'm where I am now. I don't sort of look back and worry too much about what happened at the age of 10 or 11.
Yeah, I think it's with the benefit of hindsight, it's very easy to say that, because when you're in that situation as a teenager, that is your world, and they're the things you worry about. But I think with the benefit of hindsight and life experience, you can look back and say, these things happen.
Yeah, and I just suddenly realised I used to have this. I don't remember my dreams, my actual, you know, not dreams as in aspirations, but actually dreams as in what would happen to me nocturnally. But I used to have this recurring one that I always missed an exam, a GCSE, and I failed. My whole life, you know, was spoiled by the fact that I missed an exam, and then I suddenly realised, no, it's a Saturday and the exams are not for another 6 months. but just for a moment, you know, that was the panic, and that's an interest that probably says a lot about my personality.
I have a really strange recurring dream where I'm a rugby referee, and I sort of find myself on this rugby pitch about to officiate a huge game and don't know the rules.
Yeah.
And every single time I'm thinking, I can't blag this. Yeah. There's no way out of this. I just have to invent the rule every single time. I've had it past few years. I don't know where it comes from. Some deep manifested anxiety about perhaps imposter syndrome in there somewhere.
Well, somebody will be listening to this interview, and they'll say they'll do an interview with you on their podcast, which follows up on that very point, because that sounds very fascinating. But I've got one more question for you, Dan. Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I think I'd have to say I'm looking back. I do feel I look back more than I look forward, because I can look back on things that happened, whereas I can't. I have no concept of what the future holds, and so there's a comfort in looking back because I can point to things. Whereas the future, who knows?
Yeah.
It's uncertain,
and that's part of its excitement.
It is, yeah. Yes.
Something to embrace. Yeah.
It's something to embrace. It's not something to be scared of.
Yeah.
But I do enjoy looking back.
Yeah, Dan, it has been a real pleasure to catch up with you. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.